Well, here's that ladder now. Come on, let's climb. The first rung is yours, the rest are mine. Funny,
thought Lieutenant Otto Waterhouse of the state's attorney's police.
Every time things get hairy, that damn song starts going through my head. I must be an obsessive-compulsive neurotic.
He'd first heard the song To Be a Man by Len Chandler at the home of a chick he was bawling back in 65. It expressed pretty well for him his condition as a member of the tribe. The tribe. That was how he thought of black people. He'd heard a Jew refer to the Jews that way, and he liked it better than that Soul Brothers shit. Deep down, he hated other blacks, and he hated being black. You had to climb, that was the thing. You had to climb, each man alone. When Otto Waterhouse was 8 years old, a gang of black kids on the south side had beaten him, knifed him, and thrown him into Lake Michigan to drown. Otto didn't know how to swim, but somehow he'd pulled himself along the concrete pilings, clinging to rusty steel where there was nothing to cling to, his blood seeping out into the water, and he stayed there hidden till the gang went away. Then he pulled himself along to a ladder, climbed up, and dragged himself onto the concrete pier. He lay there, almost dead, wondering if the gang would come back and finish him. Someone did come along, a cop. The cop nudged Otto's body with his toe, rolled it over, and looked down. Otto looked up at the Irish face, round, pig-nosed, and blue-eyed. "Oh, shit," said the cop, and walked on. Somehow, Otto lived till morning, when a woman came along and found him and called an ambulance. Years later, it seemed logical enough to him to join the police force. He knew the members of the gang that nearly killed him. He didn't bother with them until after he got on the force. Then he found cause to kill each of the gang members, several of whom had by then become respectable citizens, one by one. Most of them didn't know who he was or why he was killing them. The number he killed made his reputation in the Chicago Police Department. He was a nigger cop who could be trusted to deal with niggers. Otto never did know who the cop was who'd left him to die. He remembered the face, more or less, but they all looked alike to him. He had another oddly vivid memory of a fall day in 1970 when he'd been walking through Pioneer Court and had hassled a dude who was giving out free samples of all things, tomato juice. Otto took a 10 from the dude and drank some tomato juice. The guy had a crew haircut and wore horn-rimmed glasses. He didn't seem to mind having to pay a bribe, and he looked at Otto with an odd gleam in his eye as the tomato juice went down. For a moment, Otto thought the tomato juice might be poisoned. There were cop haters everywhere. Many people seemed to have sworn to kill the pigs, as they called them, but dozens of people had already drunk the juice and gone away happy. Otto shrugged and walked off. Thinking back over the strange changes that had come over him, Otto always traced them back to that moment. There had been something in the juice. It wasn't till Stella Maris had told him about Om that he realized how he'd been had, and by then it was too late. He was a three-way loser, working for the Syndicate, the Illuminati, and Discordian Movement. The only way out was down, down into the chaos, with Stella pointing the way.
"Just tell me one thing, baby,"
he said to her one afternoon as they lay naked together in his apartment in Hyde Park.
"Why did they pick you to contact me?"
"Because you hate niggers,"
said Stella calmly, running her finger down his dick.
"You hate niggers worse than any white man does. That's why the way to freedom for you lies through me."
"And what about you?"
he said angrily, pulling away from her and sitting up in bed.
"I suppose you can't tell the difference between black and white. Black meat and white meat, it's all the same to you, ain't it, you goddamn whore?"
"You'd like to think so,"
said Stella.
"You'd like to think that only a nigger whore would lay you, a whore who'd lay anybody regardless of race. But you know you were wrong. You know that Otto Waterhouse, the black man who is better than all black men, because he hates all black men, is a lie. It's you who can't tell the difference between black and white, and thinks the black man should be where the white man is, and hates the black man because he isn't white. No, I see color, but I see everything else about a person too, baby. And I know that nobody is where they should be, and everybody should be where they are."
"Oh, fuck your goddamn philosophy,"
said Waterhouse.
"Come here."
But he learned. He thought he'd learned everything Stella and Hagbard and the rest of them had to teach him, and that was a lot, piled on top of all that Illuminati garbage. But now they'd thrown him a total curve. He was to kill. The message came, as all the messages did, from Stella.
"Hagbard said to do this."
"Yes,"
And I suppose if I go along with this, I'll be told why later on, or I'll figure it out for myself. God damn, Stella, this is asking a lot, you know.
I know. Hagbard told me to have you do this for two reasons. First, for the honor of the Discordians, so that they will have respect.
He sounds like a wop for once, but he's right. I understand that.
Second, he said because Otto Waterhouse must kill a white man.
What?
Otto started to tremble in the phone booth. He picked nervously, without reading it, a sticker that said, "This phone booth reserved for Clark Kent."
Otto Waterhouse must kill a white man. He said you'd know what that meant.
Otto's hand was still shaking when he hung up.
Oh, damn,
he said. He was almost crying. So now, on April 28th, he stood at a green metal door marked 1723. It was the service entrance to a condominium apartment at 2323 Lakeshore Drive. Behind him stood a dozen state's attorney's police. All of them, like himself, were wearing body armor and baby blue helmets with transparent plastic visors. Two were carrying submachine guns.
All right,
said Waterhouse, glancing at his watch. It had amused Flanagan to set the time for the raid at 5:23 a.m. It was 5:22 and 30 seconds.
Remember, shoot everything that moves.
He kept his back to the men so they would not see the damn tears that insisted on welling up in his eyes.
Right on, Lieutenant,
said Sergeant O'Banion satirically. Sergeant O'Banion hated blacks, but worse than that, he hated filthy, lice-ridden, long-haired, homosexual, communist-inspired mortuary bomb manufacturers. He believed that there was a whole disgusting nest of them, sleeping together, dirty naked bodies entwined, like a can full of worms, just on the other side of that green metal door. He could see them. He licked his lips. He was going to clean them out. He hefted the machine gun.
Okay,
said Waterhouse. It was 5:23. Shielding himself with one gloved hand, he pointed his .45 at the lock on the door. The instructions given orally by Flanagan at the briefing were that they would not show a warrant or even knock before entering. The apartment was said to be full of enough dynamite to wipe out the entire block of luxury high-rise apartments. Presumably the kids, if they knew they were caught, would set them off. That way, they could take a bunch of pigs with them, preserve their reputation for suicidal bravery, protect themselves from giving away any information, use the explosives, and avoid having to live with the shaming knowledge that they'd been dumb enough to get caught. O'Banion was imagining finding a white girl in the arms of a black boy and finishing them off with one burst from his machine gun. His cock swelled in his pants. Waterhouse fired. In the next instant, he threw his weight against the door and smashed it open. He was in a hallway next to the kitchen. He walked into the apartment. His shoes rang on a bare tile floor. Tears ran down his cheeks.
My God, my God. Why have you forsaken me?
He sobbed.
Who's that?
A voice called. Waterhouse, whose eyes had adjusted to the darkness, looked across the empty living room into the foyer, where Milo A. Flanagan stood, silhouetted in the light from the exterior hall. Waterhouse raised the heavy automatic in his hand to arm's length, sighted carefully, took a deep breath and held it, and squeezed the trigger. The pistol blasted and kicked his hand, and the black figure went toppling backwards into the startled arms of the men behind him. A bat, which had been sitting on a windowsill, flew out the open window toward the lake. Only Waterhouse saw it. O'Banion came clumping into the room. He took a bent-kneed stance and fired a burst of six rounds in the direction of the front door.
Hold it!
Waterhouse snapped.
Hold your fire! Something's wrong!
Something would really be wrong if the guys at the front door came through again shooting.
Turn on the lights, O'Banion!
Waterhouse said.
There's somebody in here shooting!
We're standing here talking, O'Banion. No one is shooting at us. Find a light switch.
They're going to set off the bombs.
O'Banion's voice was shrill with fear.
With the lights on, O'Banion, we'll see them doing it. Maybe we'll even be able to stop them.
O'Banion ran to the wall and began slapping it with the palm of one hand while he kept his machine gun cradled in the free arm. One of the other men who had followed O'Banion through the service entrance found the light switch. The apartment was bare. There was no furniture. There were no rugs on the floor, no curtains on the windows. Whoever had been living here had vanished. The front door opened a crack. Before they could start shooting, Waterhouse yelled,
It's all right! It's Waterhouse in here! There's nobody here!
He wasn't crying anymore. It was done. He had killed his first white man. The door swung all the way open.
Nobody there?
Said the helmeted policeman.
Who the hell shot Flanagan?
Flanagan?
Said Waterhouse.
Flanagan's dead. They got him.
There isn't anybody here,
said O'Banion, who had been looking through side rooms.
What the hell went wrong? Flanagan set this up personally.
Now that the light was on, Waterhouse could see that someone had drawn a pentagram in chalk on the floor. In the center of the pentagram was a gray envelope. Otto picked it up. There was a circular green seal on the back and the words Eris embossed on it. Otto opened it and read,
Good going, Otto. Now proceed at once to Ingolstadt, Bavaria. The bastards are trying to immunitize the Eschaton. S.M.
Folding the note and shoving it into his pocket as he holstered his pistol with his other hand, Otto Waterhouse strode across the living room. He barely glanced down at the body of Milo A. Flanagan, the bullet hole in the center of his forehead like a third eye. Hagbard had been right. Despite all the advanced terror and sorrow, once he'd done it, he didn't feel a thing. I have met the enemy, and he is mine, he thought. Otto pushed past the men crowded around Flanagan's body. Everyone assumed he was going somewhere to make some sort of report. No one had figured out who shot Flanagan. By the time O'Banion had puzzled it out, Otto was already in his car. 6 hours later, when they had set up blockades at the airports and railway terminals, Otto was in Minneapolis International Airport buying a ticket to Montreal. He had to fly back to Chicago, but he sat out the brief stopover at O'Hare International Airport aboard the plane, while his brother officers searched the terminals for him. 12 hours later, carrying a passport supplied by Montreal Discordians, Otto Waterhouse was on his way to Ingolstadt.
Ingolstadt, said Fuckup.
Hagbard had programmed the machine to converse in reasonably good English this week.
The largest rock festival in the history of mankind, the largest temporary gathering of human beings ever assembled, will take place near Ingolstadt on the shore of Lake Totenkopf. 2 million young people from all over the world are expected. The American Medical Association will play.
Did you know or suspect before this that the American Medical Association, Wolfgang, Werner, Wilhelm, and Winifred Sauer are 4 of the Illuminati Primi?
Asked Hagbard.
They were on a list, but 14th in order of probability,
said Fuckup.
Perhaps some of the other groups I suspected are Illuminati Veri.
Can you now state the nature of the crisis that we will face this week?
There was a pause.
There were 3 crises for this month, plus several sub-crises designed to bring the 3 major crises to a peak. The first was Fernando Poo. The world nearly went to war over the Fernando Poo coup. But the Illuminati had a counter-coup in reserve, and that resolved the problem satisfactorily. Heads of state are human, and this feint has helped to make them jumpier and more irrational. They are in no shape to react wisely to the next 2 jolts. Unless you wish me to continue discussing the character structures of the present heads of state, which are important elements in the crises through which the world is passing, I will proceed to the next crisis. This is Las Vegas. I still do not know exactly what is going on there, but the sickness vibrations are still coming through strongly. There is, I have deduced from recently acquired information, a bacteriological warfare research center located in the desert somewhere near Las Vegas. One of my more mystical probes came up with the sentence, The ace in the hole is poisoned candy. But that's one of those things we probably won't understand until we find out what's going on in Las Vegas by more conventional means.
I've already dispatched Muldoon and Goodman there,
said Hagbard.
All right, fuck up. Obviously, the 3rd crisis is Ingolstadt. What's going to happen at that rock festival?
They intend to use the Illuminati science of strategic biomysticism. Lake Totemkopf is one of Europe's famed bottomless lakes, which means it has an outlet into the underground Sea of Volusia. At the end of World War II, Hitler had an entire SS division in reserve in Bavaria. He was planning to withdraw to Obersalzberg and, with this fanatically loyal division, make a glorious last stand in the Bavarian Alps. Instead, the Illuminati convinced him that he still had a chance to win the war, if he followed their instructions. Hitler, Himmler, and Bormann fed cyanide to all the troops, killing several thousand of them. Then their bodies, dressed in full field equipment, were placed by divers on a huge underground plateau near where the Sea of Volusia surfaces as Lake Totenkopf. Their boots were weighted at the bottom so that they would stand at attention. The airplanes, tanks, and artillery assigned to the division were also weighted and sunk along with the troops. Many of them, by the way, knew that there was cyanide in their Last Supper, but they ate it anyway. If the Führer thought it best to kill them, that was good enough for them.
I can't imagine there would be much left of them after over 30 years,
said Hagbard.
You are wrong as usual, Hagbard,
said Fuckup.
The SS men were placed under a biomystical protective field. The entire division is as good as it was the day it was placed there. Of course, the Illuminati had tricked Hitler and Himmler. The real purpose of the mass sacrifice was to provide enough explosively released consciousness energy to make it possible to translate Bormann to the immortal energy plane. Bormann, one of the Illuminati primi of his day, was to be rewarded for his part in organizing World War II. The 50 million violent deaths of that war helped many Illuminati to achieve transcendental illumination, and were most pleasing to their elder brothers and allies, the Loigor.
And what will happen at Ingolstadt during the festival?
The American Medical Association's 5th number at Woodstock Europa will send out biomystical waves that will activate the Nazi legions in the lake and send them marching up the shore. They will be, in their resurrection, endowed with supernormal strength and energy, making them almost impossible to kill. And they will achieve even greater powers as a result of the burst of consciousness energy that will be released when they massacre the millions of young people on the shore. Then, led by the Sours, they will turn against Eastern Europe. The Russians, already made extremely nervous by the Fernando Poo incident, will think an army is attacking them from the west. Their old fear that Germany will once again, with the help of the capitalist powers, rise up and attack Russia and slaughter Russians for the third time in this century will become a reality. They will find that conventional weapons will not stop the resurrected Nazis. They will believe they are up against some new kind of American super weapon, that the Americans have decided to launch a sneak attack. The Russians will then start bringing super weapons of their own into play. Then the Illuminati will play their ace in the hole in Las Vegas. Whatever that is.
The voice of the computer, coming from Hagbard's Polynesian teakwood desk, was suddenly silent.
What happens after that?
Said Hagbard, leaning forward tensely. George saw perspiration on his forehead.
It doesn't matter what happens after that,
said Fuckup.
If the situation develops as I project, the eschaton will have been immanentized. For the Illuminati, that will mean the fulfillment of the project that has been their goal since the days of Gruard. A total victory. They will all simultaneously achieve transcendental illumination. For the human race, on the other hand, that will be extinction. The end.